Good afternoon, everybody. It's my pleasure to introduce this afternoon's speaker, Dr. Erwin Neher, the director of the Membrane Biophysics Department at the Max Planck Institute for Biophysical Chemistry in Göttingen, Germany. Dr. Neher's research interests include a mechanism and modulation of neurotransmitter release from synapses in the nervous system, a natural evolution from his earlier work on ion channels and synaptic physical exocytosis. Dr. Neher earned his undergraduate degree in physics at the Institute of Technology in Munich, Germany, and in 1966 he received a Fulbright scholarship to study biophysics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where he later earned a Master of Science degree. Also, just before the lecture, he told me that he's also visited the NIH several times, including early in his career in his field of research. He returned to Munich in 1967 to carry out research on nerve excitation in the laboratory of Hans-Dieter Lux, for which he earned a PhD degree in 1970. While in the Lux laboratory, Dr. Neher became friends with Dr. Bert Sackmann, with whom he later established a collaboration aimed at measuring current flows through single ion channels in cell membranes. And together they perfected the technique of patch clamp recording and developed the different recording configurations that are so widely used today. And in 1991, Drs. Neher and Sackmann received a Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for research on ion channel physiology and for developing the patch clamp technique. They were able to observe for the first time the behavior of single proteins. Both Dr. Neher and Sackmann conclusively established that ion channels do indeed exist and provided crucial insights into their function. And it really revolutionized our understanding of signaling, and in the field of biology clearly sparked many of the advances and concepts that today underlie a lot of systems neuroscience research and other fields in terms of nervous signaling in health and disease. Dr. Neher is also known for his pioneering work, research on exocytosis, and in fact he developed the capacitance measurement technique for the study of exocytosis and endocytosis, and he led the way for using the amperometry technique to study vesicle fusion modes. And these two techniques have become the standard and are commonly used to study vesicle exocytosis and endocytosis today in our laboratories. Dr. Neher became director of the Membrane Biophysics Department in the Max Planck Institute for Biophysical Chemistry in 1983. He's also a foreign associate member of the National Academy of Sciences and of the Royal Society in London, and co-chairs the board of the European Neuroscience Institute in Göttingen. In addition to the Nobel Prize and many other honors, he's also received the Leibniz Award, the highest German award. Dr. Neher, welcome to the NIH.
Thank you, Dr. Zarouni, for this introduction, and thank you for the invitation to come here. It's a great honor to be able to deliver this lecture. Lecture, as the title says, on the role of calcium in vesicle priming and exocytosis. The lecture will be mainly a biophysical dissection of these processes, less involved with molecules. Why are we interested in understanding the role of calcium in these processes? Let me say a few words about short-term synaptic plasticity. I think this slide from a paper from Bert Sackmann's lab illustrates very nicely what it means and what the implications of short-term plasticity is. I mean, let me explain this in some detail. When you stimulate a pyramidal cell in the cortex, you can record simultaneously from two interneurons which are connected with this pyramidal cell through synapses at two branches of the axon. And what you observe in these two follower cells is in one neuron, the multipolar type of interneuron, you see a depressing response as a response to this short train of action potentials in the pyramidal cell. On the other type of neurons, the bitaptid cell, you see exactly the opposite, an increase in synaptic strength with continued stimulation. So this illustrates that each synapse has its own personality with respect to these short-term changes in synaptic strength. And this is a more surprising, since there is more or less agreement that a large component of this short-term plasticity is presynaptic in origin. So although these two terminals are terminals of the same neuron, they do have this very different short-term plasticity. So in order to understand this, of course, we need a more detailed knowledge on the calcium signals and on the mechanisms to understand this. So short-term depression is very fundamental to a number of signal processing jobs which our central nervous system is able to do. I can't go into all these different features which have been shown to be the result or can be explained by short-term depression. Let me make a point that when short-term plasticity happens, when synaptic strength changes, this of course can have many causes, since, as you know, synaptic transmission is a multi-step process, a nerve impulse, opening calcium channels resulting in calcium influx, which causes the fusion of the synaptic vesicles with the plasma membrane so that transmitter is liberated, then acting on postsynaptic receptors. And as we go through this step of events, of course, it's obvious that changes can happen on all of these individual steps. And in fact, the different forms of short-term plasticity involve most of these processes. But what I want to focus on in this lecture is the presynaptic mechanisms, mainly depletion of release radiovesicles, and then effectiveness and nature of the calcium signal inside the presynaptic terminal. I would also like to point out that we need such a biophysical understanding of these events in order to correctly interpret the results of molecular perturbations. And I think this is also obvious. I mean, if you do something to the molecules involved along this chain, and if you can only assay the final output, which is a postsynaptic depolarization, there are many opportunities to misinterpret of what happens. And the presynaptic terminal has been particularly difficult in this respect because, as a rule, presynaptic terminals are extremely small, only micrometer in size, so that the biophysical tools to study calcium signals, to study ion channels, to study also the release mechanism itself, are very difficult to apply, except for some special cases. Like here, the calyx of Held, a synapse in the auditory pathway, which has been our favorite synapse for studying presynaptic processes, because, as was shown by Ian Forsythe in 1994 and then by Gerard Borst a year later, it is possible to simultaneously patch clamp both the pre- and the postsynaptic compartment of the cell. The reason for this special situation is that the synapse here, as shown here in this schematic diagram of a brain slice in the brainstem of a rat, the synapse is part of the auditory pathway. And it is at a point before the lateral superior olive where the information from one ear first meets the information from the other ear. And probably because of the very stringent requirements which are given for sound localization. I mean, sound localization requires that we that our brain can distinguish time differences to signals between the two ears on the order of 10 microseconds and very tiny differences in sound intensities. Due to these very stringent requirements of precise signal processing, these two synapses, a first synapse in the ventral cochlear nucleus and the second synapse in the medium nucleus of the trapezoid body, the MNTB. For this reason, probably, these two synapses have this very special form of a cup-shaped, calyx-like presynaptic terminal surrounding a very compact postsynaptic cell body. And, of course, for us electrophysiologists, this is ideal because we can insert pipettes into the two compartments and, as I said, can simultaneously voltage clamp both compartments. So, diagrammatically, the synapse can be represented as a parallel array of some 500 active zones, each active zones here being shown as a cluster of vesicles presynaptically and a postsynaptic density. And we assume think that each of these active zones behaves very much like a typical glutamatergic synapse in the brain. Now, the dual voltage clamp, which we can do here routinely, allows us to, of course, record current and voltage, both pre- and postsynaptic. It allows us to control the ion concentration inside the presynaptic terminal because anything which is inside the presynaptic terminal will equilibrate quite rapidly with the compartment. It allows us to load the terminal with fluorescent indicator dyes, and what's most important for the experiments I will present, also caged compounds. This is shown here, for instance, because here the presynaptic pipette contained a fluorescent dye, a calcium indicator dye, which, as you can see here in this view through the fluorescence microscope, filled the presynaptic terminal. It also filled the axon, which is out of focus here in this illustration. Also, the two pipettes are out of focus. That's why they have been drawn in schematically. Okay, so what do we observe when we measure from the synaptic transmission? This is a very simple experiment, the postsynaptic cell under voltage clamp, the presynaptic fiber, not under voltage clamp, but stimulated at this time with an action potential. And you see a typical glutamatergic EPSC, excitatory postsynaptic current, which is a short surge of inward current, which has all the typical characteristic of an AMPA-type response. The synapse does show features of short-term plasticity, although it is generally considered to be just a very precise relay station. But you can see that with normal or somewhat elevated external calcium, when you stimulate the synapse with a pulse train of at 100 hertz, you see a very strong depression. If you do the same experiment at lower extracellular calcium, the initial signal is much, much smaller. There is a difference in scaling here. But then for the second and third stimulus, you see an increase in synaptic strength, which is a typical hallmark of short-term or paired pulse facilitation. Okay, so what I'm going to explain during my lecture is various aspects of how we presently understand these two forms of plasticity. The major, I mean, there are postsynaptic components also to the short-term plasticity, but these we eliminate by a mix of drugs which prevent or delay desensitization and prevent saturation of postsynaptic receptor. And under these conditions, then the remaining component of main component of short-term depression is in fact a depletion of the pool of release-ready granules, in the sense that at any time there is a certain number of granules which are docked and release-ready, and when you stimulate the first time, you consume a certain fraction of these vesicles, and if release probability of a given vesicle for an action potential response is relatively high, then of course you pretty soon run into a situation that you have consumed these vesicles and that then a steady state release is more or less governed by the resupply of such vesicles. On the other hand, there is the phenomenon of residual calcium. The original idea of Katz and Milady that when you give a first stimulus, calcium flows in through channels. The calcium concentration elevates in a very restricted volume. As soon as the calcium channels close at the end of the depolarization, this local domain of elevated calcium rapidly dissipates by diffusion. However, if then a second stimulus follows in rapid succession, the new calcium influx will build on top of the remaining calcium from the first stimulus, so that in the end you reach a higher calcium concentration. Oh, I think it's dying out on me here. You reach a higher calcium concentration at the release site. Now it seems to work again. this interpretation is well in line with the initial idea of Katz, namely that the release is proportional to a pool size, proportional to the number of release-ready vesicles at any given moment, multiplied by a release probability. And in my talk, I will go through these various aspects, and I will show that, in fact, calcium has a triple role. It not only triggers release, it also regulates the vesicle recruitment, and it builds up in the sense of residual calcium idea of Katz and Milady. Okay, so while I go on, I will first go into the issue, what actually is the calcium waveform at the site of the release apparatus which triggers the release. I will go on and present some evidence that during facilitation facilitation is mainly a matter of the calcium signal, not a matter of the sensitivity of the release apparatus. I will then go on to look into vesicle recruitment, show that it is enhanced by calcium in a linear fashion, which is an important aspect that is linear, because calcium triggering, of course, is a very cooperative process, and the combination of these two provides for some special features of the release process. And in the end, I will go into the importance of localization, the importance of the spatial relationship between calcium channels and release sites, and will show that, at least in the calyx, not all vesicles are in this very favorable position to sense the local high calcium signal. Okay, so the first question then is, how high does calcium rise at the release site, and what are the properties, what's the time course of this local calcium signal? And in that sense, we are now talking about the release probability, which is governed by the time course of the local calcium signal. So the problem is, of course, that with action potential activation with depolarization, calcium channels open and create, as I explained, this very local calcium gradients, and that we do not know exactly what the spatial relationship is, how far the nearest channel is from the viewpoint of a given release site. And if we look into biophysics, it's established and apparent that if you have a channel which is at, say, 8 nanometers from the release site, its effect when it opens is about 10,000-fold larger than if the same channel is 80 nanometers away. And let's try. Good. I chose 80 nanometers because 8 nanometers would be a typical distance, say, if there were molecular contact between channel and the release machinery, and 80 nanometers would be more correspond to an almost random distribution in certain cases. Anyway, since this difference between 8 and 80 makes all the difference, it is quite clear that optical imaging, calcium imaging, cannot give you that answer how high calcium rises at the thing, because both of these alternatives are within the optical resolution. And so in order to get anyway an answer, we resorted to flash photolysis, taking advantage of the fact that we can load this terminal with a so-called caged calcium compound, DM nitrofen, which is loaded with calcium, which diffuses into the terminal, spreads uniformly, and then by a flash of UV light, we can cleave it into photoproducts so that it releases the calcium and leads to a uniform elevation of calcium. At the same time, we have calcium indicator in the terminal so that we can measure this uniform calcium, and so we can establish a relationship between the calcium and the rate of release caused by this calcium. Now, I will describe this experiment in a little bit more detail, which is a kind of a key experiment. So if we do this experiment giving a weak flash, which elevates calcium to 2 nanomolar, we see postsynaptically a very small response, 200 picoamp, which is very noisy. And the reason why it is very noisy is because it is a superposition of many such so-called miniature excitatory currents, each about 20 to 30 picoamp in amplitude. And these miniature currents represent the effect of the release of the contents of a single granule. So it's the response of a single vesicle. And here we see this superposition, which means that vesicles are being released randomly at a rate of maybe a few vesicles per millisecond. If we give a somewhat stronger flash, which elevates calcium to 4 micromolar, we see a much larger current. Here now we have a 5 nanoamp scale, so that this is about 1 nanoamp. It is still a little bit noisy because, of course, it's also composed of the responses of individual vesicles. And now we take the technique of deconvolution. We deconvolve this trace with the elementary signal, which allows us to arrive at the rate, the time course of the rate of release of the rate process, which generates this signal out as a superposition of those. And the result of this deconvolution is shown here. It tells us that after reaching the 4 micromolar, release rate rises to about 10-15 release events per millisecond, and stays more or less constant over that time span displayed here. If we then give an even stronger flash to 6 micromolar calcium, we see a large EPSC, about the same size EPSC as the result of a Nrf action potential. And doing the deconvolution, we see that release rapidly reaches a rate of 60 events per millisecond, but then drops in spite of the fact that calcium stays up high. And this drop then is interpreted as the consumption of the release ready vesicles, so that like with radioactive decay, the time constant of this drop reflects the mean time it takes for a given vesicle to release at the concentration of 6 micromolar. So now we can do many of such experiments and analyze the peak release rate and the rise time or delay as a function of calcium. And this gives us this so-called dose response curve, a relationship between release rate and calcium. You see, it is a very steep relationship. It's a double logarithmic plot with a slope of here, in this case, 4.2, which means that you need at least probably 5 calcium ions to trigger the process. And we can describe this then, the release process, by a hypothetical reaction. A calcium ion binds to a calcium sensor, probably synaptotagmine, and you need at least 5 of such calcium ions to bind to synaptotagmine in order to induce this release. And the analysis of these kinetic parameters here allows us then to assign numbers to the calcium binding rate, to the dissociation rate, and also to the fusion rate of the quintuply occupied complex, so that we have a kinetic characterization of the release process. And now we can go back to the original question. What is the calcium signal which you need, given the kinetic characteristics of the release process, in order to produce a response as is produced by an action potential? So here again we have a simple experiment, again the fiber stimulation, measuring the postsynaptic current, applying a deconvolution to the postsynaptic current, which gives us this release function, the black curve here, and then we can ask the question, what driving function do we have to apply to our kinetic model in order to produce such a result? And the answer is this red curve, which indicates that the required calcium transient to produce that is a very narrow one, with a half width of about half a millisecond, and a peak in the order of magnitude of some 20 micromolar. Now, the result of such a computation depends a little bit on some model assumptions. A very similar study was done by Johann Bollmann in Bert Sackmann's lab. He came up with about the same time course, but with a slightly lower calcium. But I think there is agreement that peak calcium during release is in the range of 10 to 25 micromolar. So the conclusion from this part of our study then is that calcium uncaging allows us to establish this dose response curve, which is curve relating release rate with calcium. Given that, then we have to postulate that calcium rises to 20 micromolar and half a millisecond. Now comes in biophysical reasoning, which tells you that such high calcium concentrations and such narrow half-width are only obtained in microdomains around open channels, which rapidly close when channels collapse. And this indeed has been more recently supported by measurements by Johann Bollmann, who in a second study did not apply step-like changes in calcium, but actual calcium transients, which they produced by applying mixes of caged calcium and buffer molecules to the presynaptic terminal, so that the released calcium is rapidly taken up again. And they found that they have to provide mixes of caged compounds and buffers, which produced transients, calcium transients, and only when they produce transients as short as those predicted, with the properties of those predicted, did they obtain postsynaptic responses which were similar to action potential induced ones. Just one more word about then the biophysical analysis behind it. There is a nice study by Meinrenken and Sackmann, who modeled calcium diffusion under the conditions of calcium buffering and the geometrical conditions as they prevail at the calyx, and they found that distances, say, in the range between 50 and 80 nanometers between a vesicle and, in their case, a cluster of calcium channels is the right kind of spatial relationship to produce release probabilities on the order of those observed during action potentials. So, now, let me then switch to my second question, and this is whether calcium sensitivity changes during paired pulse facilitation. And, of course, here we are still dealing with release probability in the sense that paired pulse facilitation just is a short event which draws from a more or less fixed pool size. We are asking this question because, as I explained in the beginning, paired pulse facilitation has traditionally been explained by this residual calcium mechanism. However, since the original suggestion by Katz and Milady, there were numerous experimental data which seemed to be in conflict with this explanation. And so people have been looking for special calcium sensors which would enhance the sensitivity of the release apparatus to calcium, and so have additional ways of explaining paired pulse facilitation. There's also been experimental data to the opposite, namely that prolonged exposure to calcium desensitizes or the calcium sensor or leads to adaptation. No? In addition, Dr. Wu here at the NIH has shown that calcium current facilitates and depresses depending on the pulse pattern, and this also contributes to facilitation. And so in order to disentangle all these different conflicting or superimposing evidence, we thought that it was a good idea to test whether by calcium uncaging, whether calcium sensitivity changes during maneuvers which lead to facilitation. So the procedure is to compare the dose response curve in the facilitated state with control state, and to do so we developed a conditioning protocol which more or less simulates paired pulse facilitation compatible with the requirements of our experiment. And our conditioning protocol consisted of a 100 millisecond episode of mild depolarization, which leads to very small calcium influx, which is too small to be really measured as a current, but which can be seen in the calcium measurement that it leads to a elevation of the global calcium in the terminal up to about half a micromolar or so from a basal value of 50 nanomolar. And if such a conditioning depolarization is followed by action potential like short depolarization, the resulting EPSC is enhanced up to threefold. And this enhancement has many of the properties of paired pulse facilitation. So we compared the dose response curve in control, open circles, with that after this facilitation treatment, and I think the result is very clear. Neither in the peak rate of release nor in the delay of the onset of release is there any change. So the conclusion is there is, at least in the calyx of Held, neither a molecular facilitation of the release apparatus nor adaptation, but the pair pass facilitation is a matter of the calcium signal, partly due to changes in calcium current, partly due to superposition on a residual calcium, and probably an enhancement of the effectiveness of calcium influx. Okay, so conclusions can be added. Calcium sensitivity of the release apparatus does not change. Now I would like to turn to the next set of problems, namely the pool of release-ready vesicles and the supply of release-ready vesicles. So in doing so, I'll switch from studying release probability to studying pool size, which, according to Katz, can be seen as a product of the number of sites at which docking and priming can occur and the probability of occupancy of such sites. And since there is, plenty of evidence that the number of sites is relatively constant, we largely talk about changes in the probability of occupancy during such continuous stimulation. Okay, so question number three, how large is this readily releasable pool of vesicles? How many vesicles are there in a release-ready state? With all the possibilities given at the calyx of Held, that is relatively simple. One can just apply a long-lasting depolarization, 50 milliseconds here, producing a large calcium invert current of almost 2 nanoamp over 50 milliseconds. This results in a very large EPSC. As I said, we have to do the deconvolution then to calculate from this EPSC the release rate. This is shown here. I should point out that there is a complication. There is a large spillover current, which is due to accumulation of glutamate in the synaptic cleft. We have to allow for that in a procedure which we developed as a combination of deconvolution and noise analysis. So after correcting for that, we reach this time course of the release rate. We can integrate this and conclude that the cumulative release comes to a standstill at about 3,000 vesicles. So the, according to this technique, then, the pool of release-ready vesicles is about 3,000, has a size of about 3,000 vesicles. But if you look at the detail, you see that the decay here, and also the rise, is not exponential. If all vesicles, if the whole pool were homogeneous, if all vesicles were the same, you would expect an exponential decay, exponential rise of the cumulative curve. It is not. Even more, when we change the conditions a little bit, including more EGTA in the presynaptic terminal. I mean, the experiment before was done at a very low concentration of EGTA to keep just global calcium low. If we increase that EGTA to confine the microdomains a little bit better, we usually, very reproducibly, can obtain cumulative release curves which are clearly composed of two exponential components. One, a rapid component, which comprises about 1,500 vesicles, which is released within 2 or 3 milliseconds, a time constant of 2 or 3 milliseconds, and another component, another 1,500 vesicles, which is released tenfold slower. Okay, so during 50 millisecond depolarization, both components are dumped out, are consumed, and we now can study how these two components recover. That's what we are mainly interested in. What is the properties of this process of supplying of new vesicles. What you see here is the size of the fast component of release as it recovers. If you give two of such responses in sequence as a function of the interstimulus interval, and you can see that under control condition, this the size of this fast releasing pools recovers initially quite rapidly and then more slowly. And if we now play around with calcium, we realize that this is a very calcium-dependent process. If we increase EGDA concentration to 5 millimolar, which now is enough calcium to enough EGDA to completely clamp the calcium down to low levels, then we see it's very slow. If we clamp calcium to an intermediate level, we see an intermediate recovery time course. So the recovery of the fast pool is calcium dependent, and what this slide shows is that the calcium dependence is mediated by chymodulene. That's shown here again, looking at the recovery of the fast component under control conditions as before, then adding various types of chymodulene blockers, you see that it slows down the process to the same time course as when you clamp calcium at low levels. What's interesting is that this is a property exclusively of the fast component. If we do the same, if we analyze the recovery of the slow component of release, we see that it's extremely rapid. Within 100, 200 milliseconds, most of the slow component is has recovered. And then from half a second to thing, it has reached its final state. So that tells us that recovery can be very rapid, but this kind of recovery produces vesicles which are slow in their release. I'd just like to point out that these kind of double pulse protocols lead to a little bit of reduction in calcium current, but this is doesn't have kinetic components which correlate with any of this one. Okay, let me go into a little bit more detail regarding this recovery process. We ask the question, is this calcium dependence linear or does it have a higher order dependence? And we did a number of tests to look for this the form of this dependence. And just to summarize, we did four different tests which all indicate that the relationship between the rate of recruitment and calcium is linear, and that this steepness of this relationship is characterized by an easy-to-remember number, namely that the steepness is one pool per micromolar per second, which means that if you elevate calcium to one micromolar, you have a recovery time constant of 1 second. If you elevate it to 500 nanomolar, you have 2 seconds, and so on. This experiment here was one specific test of a linear dependence. I mean, one characteristic of a linear process is that it's the cumulative amount of recovery does not depend on the exact waveform of the calcium time course, but only on the integral of the calcium time course. So what we did here is we designed protocols of depolarization, which depletes the pool, and then again mild depolarizations of different shape, which produce a calcium time course either of this blue curve or the second protocol of this red curve. We adjusted these protocols so that the area under these curves during the recovery would be the same. And as I said, the expectation of a linear recovery process is that then the recovery is the same, which actually was borne out. A higher order dependence would predict much larger recovery during the episode of high calcium, which is not compensated by a smaller recovery during the episode of low calcium. So just for illustration of one of the four different tests on how we checked for this linearity. So let me summarize things on pools. Calyx of Health has 500 to 600 active zones with a total of about 3,000 vesicles. There are three vesicles per active zone, given that there are about 500 active zones, which release rapidly and recover slowly. And they do so in a calcium and cyclic AMP-dependent manner. I didn't show data on cyclic AMP, but what we found is that a certain level of cyclic AMP is required for calcium to have this effect of enhancing the release, the recovery. Recovery rate increases linearly and is well described by the globally measured calcium, in contrast to the calcium triggering, which of course depends on the microdomain calcium in a highly cooperative way. There are three more vesicles which release slowly and recover rapidly, but this recovery is not modulated. And also what I did not show, but which was shown by a paper by Takeshi Sakaba, that it is a rapidly releasing vesicle pool which is responsible for the synchronous release during action potentials, while the slowly releasing vesicles contribute to asynchronous release. Okay. Also, a corollary of this, which I didn't point out, all these manipulations which I showed influencing calmodulin and so on did not change the release process itself. I mean, the time constant of release at a given calcium is relatively robust, not modulated by these modulators which I showed. Okay, so let me discuss these results in the light of the dose response curve once more. Now, this is a version of the dose response curve taken from a paper by Liu and Ralf Schneckenburger from 2 years ago. Xilin Liu made a serious attempt to extend this dose response curve to low calcium. I showed before only this initial part with a slope of 4.2, but if you extend the curve to low calcium, you see that it does saturate at a basal rate of spontaneous release, which is about 2 to 5 vesicles per second on the whole synapse. A question of this paper was actually the influence of 4-pol ester. So Xilin Liu and Ralf Schneckenburger showed that under 4-pol ester, you have an increased rate of spontaneous release, and that the dose response curve under 4-pol ester can be described by the same or a allosteric model in which you only have to change the release rate of the relaxed form of the allosteric model in order to go from this dose response curve to the one under 4-pol ester, which describes, it's the red curve here, which describes, which is the dose response curve under 4-pol ester. Okay, but I wanted to use this curve to discuss my data in the context of the calcium levels that you have in a calyx. So the resting level is at 50 nanomolar. The peak global calcium after a single action potential is in the range of 0.5 micromolar. If you give a 100 hertz strain, you reach a steady state calcium during the terrain of about 1.5 to 2 micromolar. The peak microdomain is beyond the 10 micromolar. Now, if you look at this and compare it to the linear relationship which we found for the recovery from depression, you see that there is a pretty broad range of calcium concentrations from resting to about what you reach under 100 Hertz stimulation, where the recovery rate is higher than the release rate, which means that in under steady state in this range, you can build up, you can accumulate a pool of release-ready granules, which is then rapidly dumped when you switch over to a calcium level just slightly larger, factor of 3 to 5 larger, which due to this deep relationship leads to very high release rates. On the other hand, there is a range of calcium values where the steady state release is dominated or is rate limited by recruitment. I drew here this relationship as a straight line. In reality, we could measure this linear relationship only between about 0.1 micromolar and something like 1 micromolar. Probably this relationship levels off, you know, so that for any calcium values beyond a few micromolar, the recruitment of vesicles is the rate-limiting step for release. Okay, so in the end, let me go into a final question which relates to why we need two pools, what is their physiological significance, what do we learn from the properties of the two pools, why are the two pools different. I mentioned already the slowly releasing pool contributes to asynchronous release. What can we learn from the properties? One important thing that we learn from it is that recovery from depression, I mean docking and priming, can occur very rapidly, within 100 milliseconds. We learn this from the recovery of the slow releasing pool. Now, what's the difference? Either intrinsic difference in intrinsic calcium sensitivity, or is it distance to calcium channels? I mean, one very likely explanation is that different vesicles dock at different sites, some at the active zone or within the active zone, in a vicinity of high calcium channel density. The other three vesicles per active zone dock somewhere else where the calcium channel density is not as high. There is indeed a very good analogy from the work of Zenisek and Almers on the two vesicle populations in bipolar nerve terminals. Zenisek and Almers observed by turf microscopy that there are so-called residents, which are docked at special sites, which are the ribbons. Residents are more rapidly released upon depolarization, like in our case. Then they have newcomers, which come and go rapidly on all over the footprint of the bipolar nerve terminal. And they also are released slower. However, of course, there is the alternative that all vesicles may be near calcium channels, but that some of them are intrinsically less calcium sensitive. Indeed, there is some recent evidence that about an intrinsic heterogeneity between vesicles, but we think that this is not the real reason which explains the physiological difference which we observed upon depolarization. And to test what the real reason for the physiological difference is, we went back to a classical experiment by Lingang Wu and Gerard Borst, who showed already a few years ago that there is this very strange property of the EPSC elicited by a short depolarization, that when you give this short depolarization after a longer-lasting depolarization, which in our interpretation now depletes a rapidly releasing pool, you have a depressed synapse, so that a second action potential like depolarization produces no more response. You can see the difference. Here a response, here no response. Nevertheless, a long-lasting depolarization following that still elicits a large response. So even if the synapse is depressed with respect to short depolarization, there is a reserve of more vesicles, which in our hands now is the slowly releasable pool. So we repeated this experiment with the same pulse pattern, showing that after this depleting pulse, the synapse is strongly depressed. I mean, this just shows the superposition of this response and that response. And now we test at this point in the protocol whether the intrinsic calcium sensitivity of these vesicles, which are subsequently released by the long depolarization, is the same as normal or is actually changed. And this is this experiment. If we replace that depolarization by a flash of UV light, we see that there is still a rapid response, which is quite similar to the same flash of UV light given without the pre-depolarization. You can see the superposition of two flashes, one with and one without the pre-depolarization. And of course, so this indicates that these vesicles, which are released by a long pulse, are intrinsically quite sensitive to calcium. We can again do the whole dose response curve, one under control conditions and one after this partial depletion. And you can see the after depletion, the remaining vesicles are a little bit slower than the under control condition. We can fit the control curve with a calcium binding rate of 1.1 times 10 to the 8, while after half depletion it is 0.85 times 10 to the 8, so very similar, only a 30% difference, which definitely cannot explain the difference of about a factor of 10 in the response to action potentials. So, in summary, most vesicles are release competent, but this alone is not sufficient to be released to an action potential, to be released synchronously. Vesicles also have to be near calcium channels. So if we look at the normal description of the vesicle cycle, we have to conclude that actually in our hands, the most important step in this cycle, which is the rate-limiting step for recovery of vesicles after depression, which also determines the synaptic strength during ongoing release, is missing in such a scheme. We have to postulate another step, which goes between docking and priming and the release, which is the vesicles to get close to calcium channels. And we also have to add that this step, which is rate limiting, is highly modulated by calcium and cyclic AMP. So what is this step? What is the mechanism? As indicated here, one likely explanation is a sequential kind of process. Vesicles first dock at the active zone, somewhere near the active zone, become release competent in a very rapidly, and then in a slower step find their slot at the active zone to be near calcium channels. However, the alternative is as well possible, that docking and priming happens in parallel, but if there is such a parallel reaction, we have to explain why docking and priming is slow here while it is fast there. And one possible explanation for such slowness and regulation, which we have been thinking lately, is that possibly once you have used such a site near calcium channels, of course, when a vesicle fuses, this site is utterly disrupted because all the vesicular membrane will be incorporated. So maybe it takes some time until this site is regenerated. No matter what explanation holds, this what you might call a refurbishment of this site or else a lateral docking, the highly modulated and rate-limiting step which we are focused on is some kind of structural reorganization at the active zone. So, in conclusion, when you look at modulation of neurotransmitter release, that happens, of course, at the level of the action potential waveform and calcium influx, but as we showed, also strongly on the step of recruitment of vesicles, but not so much on the release process itself. Also, a kind of a lesson, vesicle recycling and docking are necessary and important steps. However, as our slow vesicles show, they can be fast and are not rate limiting. When you do succeed in interfering with this rate limiting process of vesicle recruitment, of steady state depression, you should consider not so much vesicle docking and priming, but rather look into molecules which are involved in the ultrastructural reorganization. And of course, with respect to modulation, this should be, if there is modulation of release, it should be traced to either a change in calcium influx or to ultrastructure, and not so much to snares and molecules which regulate complex formation and vesicle trafficking. So the early work has been done in collaboration with Ralf Neggenburger, who meanwhile has a position in Lausanne. The later work was done largely with Takeshi Sakaba, Nobutake Hosoi, who is a postdoctoral fellow, and Christian Wadl, who is a student of our international study program on neuroscience. Thank you for your attention.
First, let me invite everyone to a reception we'll have right outside the auditorium to thank Dr. Nair for that really wonderful seminar. I think we have time for a couple of questions, if there are any. Yes, Lingen. You want to go to the microphone?
Oh, no, very nice talk. I have a few questions. Well, you show that there are two pools of vesicles, and from your papers, we know that you have a fast and slow pool, and then the fast pool recovers slower than the slower pool, and then the fast pool also recovers by explaining one is fast and slow. So I got a bit confused. And in the normal, this is done in the 0.5 millimolar ETTA condition.
Mm-hmm.
In the more physiological condition, which is lower in the lower ETTA,
yes.
The slower component is smaller, much smaller, right?
Mm-hmm.
In your first site. And it seems to me that in the more physiological conditions, perhaps there's only one fast pool that mm-hmm. may be responsible. And so you don't need this really complicated scheme.
Well, it's a good question. It's not our fault that it's so complicated that there's not a single pool.
It is, because without the patch, you would have been able to measure the complication.
Okay. You say that at lower EGTA, the pools behave more like one pool, you know? I want to hold against that without the EGTA, you don't see the differences so clearly. You see? I mean, in our hands, our experience is that if you do not include the EGTA, the result is quite variable. You hardly ever have a homogeneous pool. You always have indications of two components, but only when you include this intermediate amount of half a millimolar of EGTA, which was selected not to reduce very much the release probability of the fast pool, but to confine as much as possible the extent of the microdomain, that you get into a position where you actually can keep the two pools nicely apart, you know? I think there are many other pieces of evidence which indicate that vesicles are not all the same, and the EGTA is just a means, experimental means, to keep them better apart. I don't want to claim that these pools are rock solidly well defined. I mean, I do think that the fast pool has very unique characteristics in that it's relatively homogeneous. It may well be that what we call the slow pool is more or less a diffuse component of vesicles which are located at various distances around the active pool. But I think the fast pool is a pool which is well defined with respect to its location and to its function.
Let's have maybe one more question. Dr. Diamond, start.
Me?
Oh, you let Jeff ask a question.
Maybe you can take turns, yeah.
Sorry. At this synapse, it's not trivial to distinguish between whether multiple pools arise at the same active zone or that you're looking at a heterogeneous population of active zones. I'm just wondering, what is an explicit piece of evidence that these two pools exist at the same active zones as opposed to
different zones? Yeah, that's a hard question. Of course, we can only look at the total response. We don't have any means to dissociate between different active zones. And it's one possibility which of course we did think about, you know, but which I didn't show in my slide, that one active zone has this type of vesicle, the other active zone has that type of vesicle. But this would require probably more complicated explanations. Yeah. You're right.
So I think we can have more discussion over refreshments. Please let's thank Dr. Nair once more for a wonderful